Last Friday, former Congressman Tim Romer, a member of the 911 Commission, said, quote, "We are only fooling ourselves if we think that financial action alone is going sufficient to cripple al-Qaeda." And also on Friday, Michael Sheehan, the former director of counterterrorism at the State Department and for the NYPD, said, "Terrorists are always bitching about money. Terrorists bitch about money the way soldiers bitch about the chow. But that doesn't mean the soldiers aren't going to fight or the terrorists aren't going to attack." So it'd be nice to think that we're making a difference here. But what are the metrics that we should be using? And in particular, Matt, you talked about a number of times in which terrorists were bitching about money. But is Sheehan right that that sort of comes to the territory?
In part, yes, he's right. It does come with the territory. Nobody ever has enough money. I've never heard anybody not complain about having enough money. But the fact is, we also know several instances where the fact that they haven't had enough money made it so that they couldn't do what they wanted to do. You know, Tim Romer, who's also a member of a task force in combating the ideology of radical extremism that we're having here at the Institute, and is a member of that task force, is right when he says this is only one tool. And I think it'll be an even more effective tool when it is used properly in tandem, cooperatively with other tools. I don't think that either quote, and Dick Clark had a quote, and I think in that article too, saying much the same, disputes anything of what we've said here. In fact, quite the opposite. If this is used as one of the tools in the toolkit and is used to constrict the operating environment, making it more difficult for them to actually carry out their activities, it can be extremely effective. It will not solve the problem. I don't like using the term, and we don't use the term in the report, draining the swamp. You will not drain the swamp. You will not get to a point where bad people want to do bad things, but gosh, it's so difficult and frustrating to get money, they just give up. So yes, soldiers will continue to fight even under difficult circumstances, and committed terrorists will continue to try and do bad things to us even when they don't have a whole lot of money, but we can make it more difficult for them to do that type of thing. And even just at the beginning of this year, in February 8, DNI Mike McConnell commented before Congress that over the past, he was saying this in February, in the previous 12 to 8 months prior to February 08, the intelligence community had noticed that, quote, al-Qaeda had difficulty in raising funds and sustaining themselves. So that's good news. Does that mean that we've won or we're near winning? Absolutely not. This is one part of the puzzle, and it can be an effective and a useful one, but if you use this one and only one, you won't get very far. If you have a busted sink and the plumber shows up with any one tool, you should be concerned. When we have a very difficult set of national security problems here, we should not come to this broken sink with any one tool.
Question, can we solve them all? Let's start over here, please. And please lean in and use the mics. And identify yourself.
Yeah, Randy Nicholson, I'm with Reuters. Randy Nicholson with Reuters. And a couple things I'm wondering. One is, is the current global financial meltdown having any kind of impact on regulation or money flows that might be felt in the financial network of terrorism? And then similarly, the UBS case against their former executive seems to be a milestone in Swiss bank secrecy and U.S. ability to crack that. And I'm wondering if you see any implications for terrorist financing there as well.
I think it's still a little too early from what I can tell to figure out how this is all going to play out. It is
just... I think it's still probably a little too early to figure out how this is all going to play out. There's obviously going to be some pressure for additional regulation in the next Congress. And as you let Congress loose, you never know what's going to emerge. But I would assume that in some part of this will be greater regulation on the financial sector, which could have, I would say, positive impact on this. On the other hand, I think obviously banks, financial institutions are under a lot of pressure now for the bottom line. And are they going to be still willing? I mean, when you're talking about cutting people, cutting money, and I mentioned the fact that compliance costs have gone up by 60% over a 3-year period, are banks still going to be okay with that? Or is there going to be a lot more pushback that we've got to find a way to cut back? We've been pressured too much on this front, and we're going to scale back our efforts. So I think that's another countervailing pressure. Let me just add that, you know, I think overall, what the financial meltdown has created is even more attention and sensitivity to risk. Risk of financial tools we don't fully understand, and reputational risk. And while I agree with Mike that there is, you know, possibility of losing positions and losing slots, and therefore a greater difficulty in balancing the amount of technology you leverage and the number of people you leverage in your compliance shops, which is an ongoing balance, I think that overall it is going to underline and highlight the need for being careful in this area. I think it's going to end up being a net plus for trying to make the international financial system more secure, whether it's from shaky and questionable financial tools and investments or abuse in a national security.
Just to follow up on that, you may find that that's true in kind of the global internet, the global financial institutions, as they feel like they're more under scrutiny in terms of what they're doing and their risk profiles and what the regulators are willing to let them do. But, for example, in the Iran context, as you have small companies in the U.S. and small companies elsewhere that are really, really concerned about trying to make ends meet, are they going to be willing to take on deals with to try to work around sanctions that they might not have been willing to beforehand? I don't know. That seems like a possibility to me as well. So, again, I think it's still probably too early to figure out how it's all going to play out, but I can think of both kind of benefits and negative effects of this.
Classic answer in Washington.
Orly Lindgren.
If you could lean into the microphone.
Orly Lindgren with Entropy Limited, a small consulting firm. You talked a lot about finance and, to a certain extent, transport trade agencies and industries. What about other industries? Now, increasingly, weapons proliferation and bioterrorism is being identified as very significant threats to the U.S. homeland and internationally as well. What about the life sciences industry, the various biotechnology industries? Do you see any payoff in tracking the finances with respect to dangerous biology around the world? And who's doing that?
Well, the question, to be honest, it's a little bit off the topic. I'll answer it this way. I think the approach should not be necessarily focused on any particular industry. It should be focused, intelligence-driven, based on following suspicious illicit activity. And if you end up having suspicious characters or entities who are then doing business in a bio area or a proliferation area, that will lead you in that direction. One of the things we highlight in the report is that this needs to be and will only be as effective as it is intelligence-driven. But I don't think that there is tremendous utility, and I don't think we have enough resources to say, well, there are potential vulnerabilities. There's no evidence of it, but it's a maybe, so let's start digging there. No one has the time or the resources for that. And frankly, you get into all kinds of privacy issues as well. What we should be doing is following a intelligence-driven and directed investigation following illicit funds.
I would just add that one thing this administration has actually tried to do, which I think has been a positive, is increase the focus on export control issues, which is where I assume some of the issues would get tied up in that. They've actually got an export control coordinator now at Justice Department to basically try to coordinate all of the various investigations across the U.S. Attorney's offices in the country. And they've also pressured other countries. For example, the United Arab Emirates put in place an export control law for the first time in 2007, which actually enabled them to restrict exports for national security reasons for the first time. I think a lot of that's going to take place in the export control arena. So I think there have been some gains, but it's a really, really hard thing to crack down on. And just having spent a decent amount of time in the UAE for this, which is a huge re-export market, particularly for Iran, where you can be a company and you can just send something off to a country where it seems perfectly, you think your buyer's in Dubai,
and you send something off to Dubai, and it turns out that that's actually just an Iranian front company, and they're just reshipping it to Iran. So I think it's a really hard area, particularly in the export control arena, where some things are legal to be sent to one country and not to another, and trying to, and with the volume of international trade, to regulate that is not easy. But I think this administration has started to focus on that, but I would anticipate the next one would probably continue on that front.
Go all the way back, please.
Mark Ginsburg with AFCO Worldwide. First of all, I want to commend both of you, Mike and Jacobson and Mike, for an outstanding job. You know, no one really realizes what a wonderful job the two of you have been doing over the years, facilitating so much of the investigation. And I know the work that both of you have been doing, and it's really fantastic, and I look forward to reading your report. Can you take me on a quick little survey of several countries that you have not mentioned? Somalia and pirates, one. Syria, secondly. Pakistan, third. What do you see going on in each of those three places with respect to non-compliance? With Syria, obviously we know that they were a depository of huge amounts of money left over from the Saddam regime. As well as a transit point for terrorist activities. What's the situation also with Pakistani banks? Thank you.
I've always liked you. Thank you for your compliment. Very, very wise man. Somalia is a non-country. And so our ability to see what's going on there is inherently limited, as it would be in any area where ungoverned area, Gaza, etc., and it's a significant vulnerability. There aren't a whole lot of banks.
I also wanted you to, in the Somalia context, I wanted you to give us your assessment of Yemen,
which is exactly my next sentence. Because Mike mentioned the focus on Hawaladars in the UAE. The UAE, Yemen, Somalia, and then in the other direction of Pakistan, unofficial banking system is very, very prominent. That is not necessarily focused on illicit activity. It's there for many, 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 many years, and it's there for primarily perfectly legitimate activity, but it's there, of course, for abuse by all kinds of people. And this is one of the areas where we're going to have to be especially focused on unofficial banking of a Hawaladar or trade-based money laundering nature in particular. In Somalia, of course, there is the additional issue now of piracy. I understand that a Saudi tanker was just hijacked. That will make for some interesting follow-up. But Somalia definitely is and on its own, and then together with Yemen and this Hawala transit route, a vulnerability. We want to be able to make sure that people, whether they're in Minnesota sending money to their family home in Somalia or elsewhere, can send money home, but we also have a serious terrorist presence there, and it's not only ungoverned but largely unknown. Syria, it's a lot easier to answer. Syria is a card-carrying and original member of the state sponsors of terrorism list. It's been subject to all kinds of executive orders related to terrorism and support for the insurgency, etc. Perhaps most significant in this regard was that one of the few times that the 311 authority under the Patriot Act was used in a terrorism context was targeting the Commercial Bank of Syria. I think that says a lot. We didn't talk in our comments, but we have a whole section in the report on state sponsorship of terrorism. This is still a very significant issue. Iran is the most significant actor there, described as the international banker of terrorism with a 9-digit line item in its budget for terrorism. But Syria continues to play that kind of a spoiler role, with the Israeli military talking about interest in peace talks. Who knows what could happen. But in the meantime, Syria continues to play a destabilizing role in all of this. We saw this most recently, actually, while Mike and I were in the Gulf, in terms of the U.S. attack over the border in Syria against the Abu Ghadir network. Abu Ghadir network that had already been designated by Treasury when it was in its earlier stages just playing a logistical and financial support role. And then Abu Ghadir and other members of his network apparently started playing a much more direct role in attacks themselves. Pakistan is a very interesting situation, especially now with opportunities that could present themselves with the new civilian government. In general, you know, we have been wary of pushing Pakistan too far for fear of doing things that will further destabilize it. One of the big problems we saw, for example, was in terms of their oversight of not just banking, but their charitable sector during the earthquake in Kashmir, for example. The most prominent, and to be honest, because they tend to be very effective, charity on the ground was Jamaat-ud-Dawah, tied to Lashkar-e-Taiba. Both Lashkar-e-Taiba and Jamaat-ud-Dawah itself have been designated by the UN, by the US, and the Pakistani government did not appear to be particularly willing to take action, and that presented a significant difficulty. So you've highlighted three. There are arguably others, countries where we're nowhere near where we need to be yet. But I think part of what Mike was highlighting is that despite all the progress we've had, we still have a lot of progress to be made, even in areas of the world and with countries that have started to turn a corner, even with close allies in Europe, we're still not where we need to be on this issue. So even before we get to the Somalias and the Pakistans and the Syrias, there's a lot more to be done to make this as effective a tool as it could be.
And I would just add, we do have a section of the report talking about safe havens and the implications of having these safe havens for particularly raising funds, transferring funds, storing funds, and what they enable terrorist groups to do. And obviously, I mean, just look at the tribal regions of Pakistan, where it's made Al-Qaeda's life a lot easier, having somewhere they can operate from a little more securely. One of the interesting issues, I think, in terms of, particularly I remember coming up with Pakistan, was when you talk about like the big global financial institutions that have arms or branches in this area of the world, they are subject to the same oversight. They have to follow the same kind of rules that they do everywhere else. And so when you talk about a global institution that's operating there, I have kind of less concerns. What we heard more about also was some of the, let's say, a small bank in Dubai that also is doing business in Pakistan or wherever else. And the U.S. really doesn't have much leverage over these kind of banks. They're not planning on doing business in New York. They don't do a lot of dollar business. And so what the U.S. is able to force them to do or try to use as leverage doesn't often work. So I would be more concerned about kind of the smaller regional banks and the activities they're involved in countries like Pakistan and about the kind of the big players. But I think also one of the interesting things we heard about is people tend to think of this as to make improvements in this area as something that would require a lot of money. And given the billions of dollars that are spent on counterterrorism, I think it makes sense logically. But it's not always large amounts of money. And this anecdote really stuck with us when we were interviewing one of the senior UN officials. He was talking about being on a trip to Africa and one thing that governments are supposed to do is take the UN's list of terrorists and send it to the border guards, to the airports, around to the financial institutions, make sure that everyone who needs to know who's on this list has that list. And he asked the country, okay, are you sending around the UN's list to the banks, to the border guards, et cetera, to the airport? They said, no. He said, why not? They said, well, we don't have computers, so it's too hard to do that. We said, well, why don't you print hard copies and mail them? They said, well, we're only allowed to have one toner a month for our office, and this list is way too long, and so it's going to burn through too much of our toner budget. And so I think when you hear something like that, you start to realize that it's not always large sums of money that will make some improvements. And I think the next administration has to do a good job identifying where small amounts of money might actually make a difference. And now talking to one other part of the UN, I think they've really started to focus on Africa specifically. Obviously, there are countries that are going to be more difficult to make progress, and it depends in part on the political will. But I think that their feeling was in countries like Mali and Mauritania, where they're going to spend a lot of their time, and they feel like smaller amounts of dollars could actually make bigger improvements in the country's counterterrorism regimes.
Thank you.
Dmitry Sidorov, Commerce and Russian Business and Political Daily. Two questions. First one, Flint Leverett for a number of years is trying to push the idea of what he calls a great bargain. And do you think the this idea will help to, for the next administration, I mean, do you think that this idea will help Obama's administration to persuade Iran to give up his support, financial support for different terrorist organizations and countries? And the second thing is, in your document, you didn't mention Russia, and I'm trying to, the question is, I'm trying to figure out, you didn't mention Russia because there's no cooperation in this on this particular issue between the Treasury Department and the Russian Finance Ministry, or you have, or there's any information that the Russian government is assisting terrorist organizations or countries. Thank you.
There are lots of countries we didn't mention in our presentation. I don't think that you should walk away from that thinking with the conclusion that Russia is therefore financing terrorism, or necessarily that Russia is doing all that it can on this issue. There is, you know, Russia tends to do a you stroke my back, I'll stroke your back approach to most things on international relations. And so Russian agreement or compliance on international multilateral UN designations in particular usually comes with some type of cost. And that can be frustrating when we're trying to, for example, designate an al-Qaeda target that is threatening all of us. In terms of Flint's grand bargain, that gets way beyond just the issue of terror finance. I would just say this. To the extent that Iran is interested in a negotiation that doesn't have any preconditions, I think that that's something that the next administration would have to apply from both ends. And while this is really more on the counterproliferation finance measures, I would say that these are very effective tools. In the Iran context, they've been extremely effective, that need not be taken off the table as a precondition for those types of talks. They are intended to create leverage for diplomacy and therefore should not be taken off the table until that leverage has actually led to something. So, you know, theoretically, is there a grand bargain that could, you know, take Iran out of the terror financing business? That would be welcome. Whether or not that is a likely thing, I think maybe Flint and I would disagree.
I think on Russia, this list, the UN list, I think, which really started off as kind of narrowly targeting al-Qaeda and the Taliban, it's really gotten broader over time. And there's certainly al-Qaeda affiliates on there, but the difficulty has been, as you broaden it and as you say what is defined as a link to al-Qaeda becomes more of a debate, then it allows countries like Russia, countries like China, to put in, well, this is our, the Chinese Uyghurs you hear a lot about some of the Chechen separatists that you end up, and so it becomes difficult at the UN sometimes to, okay, where do we draw the line on what is al-Qaeda? Is al-Qaeda someone that you can prove direct funding links with, that you can show ideologically inspired by, et cetera? But I think this is one of the areas that becomes a, so if a country puts, and it becomes a bargaining game about, okay, well, this is, we think that this is al-Qaeda, and then we'll release our hold on this if you release your hold on Y. And so I think it's a pretty complicated political arena at the UN in terms of this this terrorism list.
Tom Johnson, you mentioned the Turkish government's defense of Qadi, saying that somebody on this list, being on this list doesn't mean you're guilty. Could you say a little more about that issue of human rights and appeals process and delisting? And because especially in Europe, this has been a big issue, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, it's always interesting because you hear the U.S. list criticized as well quite a bit. And the U.S., I think, has had the most robust system in place, which they've had in place for, I don't know, the sanctions go back to, I think, probably 70 years or so, the U.S. sanctions. And so it's a well-established process, and the role of the judiciary in this is very clear. And the fact that in the U.S. you can sue, that you can have an independent judge review the whole entire package, including the classified information. It's been, the U.N. list and the European Union list are much newer. And so I think it's been trying to figure out what is the right balance to strike. And I think the UN list started off as basically just, okay, let's get agreement and that's good enough. And I think it's been evolving towards trying to figure out what kind of due process do you build into this, whether or not it's a focal point for delisting, where somebody who's on the list no longer has to get the approval of their home government to file a petition for delisting with the UN, and now can petition the UN directly. I mean, there's some proposals out there right now on the UN list that to have an independent body to look at designations, and if somebody sues, that you could have an independent body look at the whole package. But this has been one of the issues that they've really been struggling with, I think, in both UN and Europe on this issue. And I think it'll be interesting to see how exactly the European Union interprets this latest European Court of Justice decision, which really took issue with that exact premise, the idea of due process and transparency, and whether or not they'll interpret it narrowly the way they did in the MEK case a few years ago, and basically think, okay, well, we've got to give the person on the list a little more information about why they're on there, but that's it. Or are they going to open this up for, okay, we're going to have a judge who can look at the entire classified package in the way that you have in the U.S. But I think it'll be that is a decision that'll be coming, I think, fairly shortly.
If I could just add, we've long had a disagreement, a developing discussion with the Europeans on what is the threshold. You know, what is this? Is this supposed to be a criminal threshold or not? We've always seen this as something short of criminal prosecution and administrative action, but one that requires due process and presenting some information. I mean, to date, the United States is the only entity out there, any government, international organization out there, that makes public any information about why it does these designations, though that's supposed to change. The UN, I think in January, is supposed to start presenting some type of declassified fact sheet. And that, so it's not just kind of how the International Court of Justice, the European Court of Justice rules, which of course has tremendous ramification for European member states who could be put in the difficult position of being told under European law they can't do something and under UN Chapter 7 obligations they have to do something, but also and more of an agreement internationally on what is the threshold and what is the purpose for these types of actions. And part of that should also be, if you really want this to be an effective international regime, then the multinational United Nations sanctions regimes cannot be only available for Al-Qaeda and Taliban-related entities. The United States, for example, would love to be able to approach the international community about, you know, FARC or ETA or Hamas or Hezbollah or Jewish extremist groups or what have you. You can't. You cannot designate anything at the UN except for Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, and that is a tremendous shortcoming also. And countries have either unilaterally or through regional bodies like the EU tried to fill that gap, and that's why, one of the reasons why we've had kind of parallel, similar but not quite the same systems, and I think these are some of the areas where there's room for improvement. To my feeling, though, this is something that is imminently doable and should be fixed, not abandoned.
I'm Barbara Ledeen from the Israel Project. I wanted to mention also, with regard to what you just said about the United States being the only government that has this kind of level of scrutiny, a federal judge in Oregon has just ruled that a law prohibiting material support for terrorists is unconstitutional because it's too vague. So it looks like we're actually importing the European version rather than exporting our version. This judge said that the Treasury Department violated the rights of the Oregon chapter of a defunct Islamic charity group based in Saudi Arabia. So I think we need to pay attention over here, particularly with the Judiciary Committees on this issue.
Well, I just want to say that one of the things that we talk about in the report, and I think that the U.S. government hasn't always done well enough, is there's kind of the myth out there that the U.S. list is just a black hole. You end up on it, there's no way off, there's no way to contest it, and I think very few people know about the kind of the legal process that's actually built in. So when I hear some of the this is a different one, but I think one issue that I think the U.S. government has not always done very well is they highlight listings very well. I mean, they put out, as Matt said, more information than anyone else in the U.S. about why somebody is on the list. Some of the public statements are pretty detailed. They haven't done much on delistings. And, for example, there was somebody delisted about a year ago, and I only found out because somebody, I think, happened to be looking at the OFAC list and noticed that they were off the list. And Treasury, there was no accompanying press release. And I think it's actually a good thing to demonstrate to the world, like, look, this is not a list that you end up on and are automatically on there. If we got it wrong, if you're suddenly cooperating with the government, if whatever it is, I think it's just as important to highlight the fact that this is a real list with real due process built in and that you can work your way off. So I think the U.S. has to do a better job as to highlighting that part of the process as well.
I have to add, there are a variety of different lists, of course, and some of the lists include individuals, some of the lists include organizations. And I'm concerned that our listing of organizations for their terrorist activities, that there are only two organizations which continued to exist while they were delisted, one of which promptly went out of existence, and the other which promptly resumed terrorist activities. I'm concerned that in the 15 years before we turned to a terrorism list system, two of the largest and most important terrorist organizations in the world, the IRA and the PLO, abandoned, at least temporarily in one case, their terrorist activities. In the period since we have turned to the use of this list system, I'm not aware of any such organization which has done this. And that raises a question as to what extent we are approaching the listing of organizations as part of a process of how do we persuade groups to abandon their terrorist activities, and to what extent do we approach it as part of a process of draining the resources available to organizations. And I am particularly concerned that it does not appear that anyone in the U.S. government has been prepared to provide at least one organization which wants to get off the list with information about what it must do to get off that list.
Though there have been, I mean, there are multiple lists, as you said. There have been plenty of organizations, for example, on the FTO list that have been taken off, again, in the PLO context especially. A lot of the alphabet soup groups were on for many, many years and are off now.
Maury Amatek. I was interested in your reference to suspicious activity reports. Are they any different with regard to terrorism to the reports that banks routinely do, I think, for any transfer of more than $10,000, or is this part of that?
Yeah. It's all part of the same general reporting requirements. I mean, the obligations for suspicious activity reports are, it's an international obligation. That's one of the things that the Financial Action Task Force laid out, is that countries should have a financial intelligence unit, which is the entity that receives these suspicious activity reports. There, what you're talking about is also currency transaction reports, which is right. a different type of report that, and just an interesting anecdote on that, that, no, sorry, I'll let you, is that you look at I always found this fascinating during the 9/11 commission, as we were looking at how Al-Qaeda pulled this off, and Massawi, when he came into the country from Europe, that he actually had about $35,000 with him in cash as he came in. And he actually filled out the form to declare this to the U.S. government. And I always found this fascinating that Al-Qaeda had obviously, I mean, he's not a normal man who was, but I mean, he was obviously advised that, okay, this is going to be, here's the cash, you have to understand that this is the requirement. And the fact that Al-Qaeda had paid attention to what our various regulations are on something like cash transactions. And so, and then at that point, he filed the report, he had followed the law and went into the system and he came into the country. But I always thought that was interesting, the kind of attention that Al-Qaeda sometimes paid to our regulations.
And by the way, we heard in several places when we were in the Gulf that in some ways, you know, there have been several instances, for example, where just Saudi or other students who have come to the United States wanted to open up accounts, had a hard time doing it because of the slow pace of implementing things in a smart way, and parents ended up feeling the only way to get money here was to send cash, which then, of course, generates suspicious activity reports. And you know, there was a lot of concern that, you know, we need to really kind of make these things operate more smoothly. We didn't want to send cash, but we found it was the only way to get it in.
Well, speaking of operating smoothly, we always promise that we will operate smoothly and promptly at 2 o'clock. Let me urge you on your way out to grab hold of a copy of the report.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi.